Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Welcome to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Thanks for spending some time with me today. A lot of Western medical care focuses on finding cures, which is great. But what about chronic conditions? How can we make living with a chronic condition a better experience, even while still searching for your cure? This is precisely the question that Dr. Tia Powell seeks to answer in her new book, Dementia Reimagined, Building a Life of Joy and Dignity from Beginning to End. Dr. Powell directs the Center for Bioethics and the Bioethics Master's Program at Montefiore Health and Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York City. She also holds the Shoshana Trachtenberg-Frackman Chair in Biomedical Ethics and is a professor of epidemiology and psychiatry. Psychiatry is how you say that. I'm very pleased that she joins us here to discuss how we can make caring for loved ones with dementia a more dignified and simply a better experience. Dr. Powell, welcome to All of It.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
And listeners, are you a caregiver for someone with dementia? We'd love to hear from you. You can give us a call to tell us about your experience or if you are seeking advice about providing the best care for someone in your life. Our number is 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. We would like to hear from you about this topic. So Dr. Powell, let's get some baseline numbers. What percentage of the U.S. population is likely to be diagnosed with dementia if they live to be 85?
A big percentage. Depending on what study you look like, it's something like at least 30%, maybe as much as 50%. So that's a lot of us. I do in a lot in the book and in a lot of the talks, I give comment on the fact that I think I am very likely to end up with dementia. But you also shouldn't feel that sorry for me because I'm taking a lot of your listeners with me when I go. I won't be alone there.
A lot of us will be in the same boat. Yeah. You write in the intro, quote, there is no effective cure or prevention and none to arrive in the immediate future. Why no prevention?
Prevention is a good question. There are things that you can do that help, but there's nothing that's proven that if you do this one good thing, you're good to go. So it's a subtle, it's kind of a nuanced message. There are definitely things that you already know are good for you that are definitely good for dementia prevention as well. Being fit, exercising is the single thing that shows up in every study. Can't go wrong. You know it's good for you. You know it's better than sitting on the couch. You should do it. And there are other things too. Diet comes and goes in different studies. I think that's partly because diet's really hard to study because we cheat. Everybody remembers the green beans. Everybody writes down, I totally had green beans. And they kind of like would rather forget about the McFlurry, you know. So it's very hard to get good data over decades from thousands of people, which you really need to show the benefit of good diet.
Why no cure in the immediate future?
So there's, and this is bad news. This is tough, but we'll go at it straight. If you have Alzheimer's disease, which is the most common form, you have these plaques and tangles forming in your brain. That kind of pathology starts at least a decade, maybe more, before you even have symptoms. So before you're showing any signs of dementia that somebody can see, your brain is changing. So that's one set of 10 years. There's another set of 10 years, and that is any great idea is going to take about 10 years before it's going to get to be something that you can sign up for and receive a medication, an important kind of intervention, you know, sort of form of brain stimulation, something like that. So if you add the first 10 years and the second 10 years, the answer to that equation is it's too late for the baby boomers. So a lot of us are on the pathway to dementia. I want to stress, though, I don't think that's a reason to be hopeless. I think that there are things you can do. Living healthfully can keep you from piling on whatever problems you have with your DNA, with things that have already happened. If you were a soldier and you had a traumatic brain injury, all the more important for you not to smoke, for you to stay fit, for you to watch your diet. And I also think that every life should have joy. And a life with dementia can have that too. I mean, I think people with disabilities have made an incredibly important contribution to the way we think about the value of life. People with disabilities routinely rate their quality of life higher than their doctors do, than other people do. So they show us, guys, you know, I may have this disability or that disability. That doesn't mean I can't find joy in my life. So for those of us who don't have dementia, to sit back and go, oh, that's horrible, that's the worst, that's just totally not worth living that life. I'm on a kind of...
mission?
Yeah, I am on a mission. It's, you know, I really, and I'm not alone there, to really change the way people think about dementia. I actually really want to revolutionize. When we say the word dementia, what's the picture that comes into your mind today? And it's really often the end. Dementia takes a long time, and what we picture is the end of it, which is a sad picture, definitely. Somebody bedbound, probably can't speak, all the things that you think of. But that person spent a long time getting there. Spent a decade where they were hanging out with their family, where they were sitting next to you in the restaurant, where they were on the bus with you. I mean, and that life, there's a lot of room for more support, for better ways to think about how do you not circumscribe somebody's freedom? How do you let people be adults, mm-hmm. make choices, even risky choices sometimes, but also give them a bit of a safety net without kind of tying their hands all together? I'd love for us to think more about that.
My guest is Dr. Tia Powell. The name of her book is Dementia Reimagined, Building a Life of Joy and Dignity from Beginning to End. If you'd like to call in, join this conversation. If you're having an experience with dementia in your family, our number is 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. You mentioned Alzheimer's. I do want to define terms. Mm. Alzheimer's and dementia, they're not synonymous, right?
Well, they're not synonymous. Dementia is the overall umbrella term.
Okay.
So that is the big category, and lots of other types of dementia fit in there. Alzheimer's dementia, that's one type of dementia. There's also Lewy body disease, which Robin Williams had. There's vascular dementia, mm-hmm. which is really common, and that's what you might get for a big stroke. That's also what you might get from little mini strokes that we don't even necessarily know about, like little teeny mm-hmm. ping, 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 you know, from high blood pressure, from whatever. We think that does a lot of damage to the brain. And there's dementia involved with Parkinson's disease, with AIDS, with all kinds of different things.
Okay. Kirkus Reviews, they said of this book, it was really interesting, a potent hybrid of medical history / journal and memoir. As you decided to write this book, did you originally start out to write a memoir and then weave in the medical and the history, or did it start as medical and history and then the memoir came too?
I'm not really sure. I mean, I'm very aware that in thinking about dementia, particularly during my mother's illness, my grandmother had had dementia, but I was less aware and I wasn't really a working physician yet at that point. By the time my mother was quite ill, I sort of thought, well, I'm a, you know, an academic physician. I'm a psychiatrist. I should know all about mm-hmm. this. And I totally didn't. I didn't have it together at all. I didn't know anything that I needed to know as a family member. And my brothers and sisters and I had to work really hard to figure out, like, what's the right thing to do here? Are there solutions that are great for everybody? Are there things that would be particularly good for our mother? I didn't know about that. And I thought, that is really a shame. And I think that this is a very common illness, and that there are probably a lot of people that are similarly thinking, I need a light in the wilderness, mm-hmm. you know? So I thought, I will try and figure out some things that I find helpful, and I would love to be able to talk to other people about that and see if that's useful to them.
So you mentioned your frustrations as Dr. Powell,
right.
not knowing that much. What were your frustrations as Tia, the daughter?
So that's really hard. I mean, I think... I have some good qualities. It is possible that patience is not first among them. It's really hard to be good to somebody with dementia. It's really hard when people ask you the same question over and over again. And I remember a conversation with my mother where we're talking on the phone. I live in a different city. And she said, the kids who live in Washington, D.C., they just went away and left me here. And I went, you know, Mom, I actually spoke to you yesterday on the phone, and my sister was there too, and we all three had a cheerful conversation together. So mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure that that's not quite the case. And she said, if you say so. And she continued on sort of ragging on me, ragging on her life, ragging. And Celia and I totally get that. And every time I would try to, like, say something to cheer her up or say, well, you know, maybe, you know, you were just out last night doing something, she would say, if you say so. And it just drove me around the bend. So it's a really small example, but it just, it's tough. It's tough to be caring for somebody who's going through a phase that may make them more difficult.
Yeah, it's so interesting. And I can remember reading about especially bright people can often mask their dementia for a very long, which I found with my mom. When we cleaned up my parents' house, I found notebooks. She took notes of our phone conversations.
Wow.
So that the next day she had the information. So that there wasn't that, you didn't say that.
Wow.
Yeah, it was really, it was both heartbreaking, and I thought, you were an amazingly smart woman.
Seriously, resilient.
You found your workaround. In hindsight, I wish I had known that, but I thought that was a fascinating thing that my mom
Absolutely.
Had done.
Yeah.
Let's take a call. Sarah is calling us from Howell, New Jersey. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Allison. Hi, Dr. Powell. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's up, Sarah?
So I had a question regarding some practical advice for my father-in-law. So he is not experiencing any symptoms of dementia or Alzheimer's yet, but both his mother has passed from it and his father is currently in a home with advancing Alzheimer's. So how can we help, you know, his brain to stay sharp so we can, you know, either prevent or kind of turn this ship around?
So that's a great question, and that really is the question that a lot of super smart people are really working on. We don't have a perfect recipe for you or for him to really say, do this, and you won't get dementia. But there are, as we were talking about a minute ago, there are some good things you can do. General healthy living, do the things that make you happy today. Be with people, be socially engaged, be intellectually engaged, be fit. Actually, one of the best things you can do is find somebody you love to talk to and go walking with them, because the combination of having to walk and be fit and also engage with somebody personally, first of all, it just makes you happy, and it's actually really good for every part of you. So there's small things like that that can make a difference. I'd also say, I think the psychological part of it's really important. I think it's important that we address shame. A lot of people feel really ashamed as they get older and they feel they're not as sharp as they were. So I think it's important that he know that you don't expect to think less of him if he changes with time, as we all will, that, you know, he enjoys your love because of who he is, not because of, you know, whether or not he can recite the Constitution from memory. I also think there's some practical steps. I think there are a lot of financial scams. There are a lot of people that call up older people and try to get them to give them their bank account number. If you can talk to his bank, maybe talk to him, or absolutely talk to him and see about what protections are there. Can you have, you can set up third-party monitoring on a bank account so that you guys don't control his bank account, but you'd be able to look and see, is there some unusual activity? Has somebody hacked his account? Has somebody figured out how to do identity theft? You know, you might be able to do some stuff like that. And think of other ways in which people can protect themselves in advance, either financially or just in terms of other ways. Think about where you're living. Is it a good place to age in place? That kind of stuff, I think, can be very helpful.
Sarah, good luck with everything. Let's go to Lisa on line 8. She's calling us from Far Rockaway. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, how is everybody today?
Doing well. How about you?
Great. I'm a speech-language pathologist from Kansas City, actually. And I live in Far Rockaway now, though. And I work in an exclusively Alzheimer's and dementia nursing facility, 178 beds of just patients with Alzheimer's and dementia diseases. And one of the things that I have several stories, I don't know if you're interested in them, but one of the things I wanted to bring up that I think is so important, I would have family members come to visit their loved one. And they would say to me on their way out of the building, you know, mom doesn't even recognize me. She doesn't even know who I am. Why should I keep coming to visit? Mm. And one of the things I would say to them is, you know, your loved one knows, they may not know your name and they may not remember that you were here, but when you're here, they're happy. because they know they care about you and they know that you care about them. So it leaves almost an emotional residue. I found a lot working with people with dementia, they would be happy about something and the happiness would last even though they might not be able to tell you what it was that was making them feel happy. Or like if they watch CNN and see something terrible, there's this emotional dementia of being upset, emotional residue of being upset. And they may not remember what they're upset about. They just know they're upset.
Well, let me can I comment on that? Because I think what you're saying is so important and so interesting. I agree with you completely. I think it was true for my mother, and I think it's true for a lot of people with dementia, that even though they may not remember your name exactly, there's a real smile of recognition. I think people know who's on their team. They know, that's a face I like. I like the look of that person. And there is a kind of warmth. And there is that continuing sense of well-being that happens, that stays with somebody even when they may not remember. I also want to just comment quickly, you're a speech and language therapist. That work is so important. As you know better than anybody, more than 90% of people with end-stage dementia have difficulty swallowing. And long ago, we used to always end up giving feeding tubes to people like that. And we now know that feeding tubes in end-stage dementia, they don't increase the duration of your life, and they certainly don't increase quality of life. So the speech and swallowing therapists have a lot to say, a really big role in helping educate people about, you know, doing hand feeding, helping people get by without that feeding tube.
Let's try to slip in one more question before we have to break. Let's go to Kim on line 7. She has a very specific question. Hi, Kim.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I will be brief. My mother-in-law, her father died from Alzheimer's, so she often talks about that it is in her genetic makeup, and she's 72, we're starting to see signs where she forgets people's names she's known for a long time. She'll tell the same story 3-4 times, you know, within an hour. And she has gone to the neurologist, and she went a year ago, and he's like, oh, you're just a forgetful person, don't worry. And then she just went again last week as a 1-year follow-up, and he's like, oh, you're just anxious, you need to see a psychiatrist. And so what my question is what questions or tests should we be asking neurologists to do to help identify symptoms, you know, and issues early?
Excellent question.
It really is a good question. I'm going to say something a little bit mean. I think you need a different neurologist. I think a geriatrician maybe a different neurologist might be able to address things in a more holistic way. There are still a lot of doctors who don't think that it's right to tell somebody when they think they have dementia. Since there's no cure, they figure, well, what? You're not going to do anything about it. But, you know, I'm a bioethicist in background. When a doctor examines you, that's your information that they have. You have a right to know that, unless you say, listen, doc, don't tell me, tell my kids, I don't want to know. You know, and that's a free choice, too. But I think that people have plans to make. If I were going to have dementia, if somebody knew that for sure, I would want to be on the list of people who knew that. I'd really want to, like, double check, get people to kind of help me set things up. The things I was mentioning earlier, I want to take care of money, make sure that's set where it is. Housing, what do I need to deal with? So I think there is a holdover of people not giving that information out directly. I certainly don't know if your loved one has dementia. I didn't examine her. I don't know. But dealing with that issue, you can do simple tests that test memory. That shows you have a problem with memory. It doesn't prove you have dementia, but it might help you think about, is this depression? Is this thyroid? Let me go through and check the things that are reversible that I can fix. And if it does look like dementia, let's think about that. Let's think about what you might like to tell me if later you can't tell me. And I think you really rob people, not only of their rights, but of their capacity to set up the kind of future that they would like. And if they don't set it up, somebody else will do it, and we might not do it as well.
My guest is Dr. Tia Powell. The name of her book is Dementia Reimagined, Building a Life of Joy and Dignity from Beginning to End. We'll continue our conversation with Dr. Powell after the break, and we'll get to more of your calls. This is All of It on WNYC. Welcome back to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart, and my guest this hour is Dr. Tia Powell, and we've been discussing her new book, Dementia Reimagined, Building a Life of Joy and Dignity from Beginning to End. And listeners, are you a caregiver for someone with dementia? Call us and tell us about your experience, or if you have some question or comment about providing the best care for someone in your life, we'd love to hear from you, 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. I do want to talk to you a little bit about care, which is a big part of what you write about. And the idea that at one point you write in your book, bad care is the default.
Right.
Why do we see these failures in today's care for people with dementia?
Well, in some ways it's easiest to talk about end-of-life care. So appropriately, medicine is aimed toward preserving life. And we have a motto that we use pretty often, which is that you err on the side of life. If you're going to make a mistake, you'd rather go in the direction of supporting life. And that's very important. That's right to do. When somebody, however, is at the end of a fatal disease, we know we don't have a cure. Everything we could do, we did do. And that's true for whether you have cancer or congestive heart failure, whatever it is that is the fatal disease that you have. And by the way, a lot of people with dementia, because they're older, have more than one fatal disease. To say at that point, well, we should put her in the ICU, maybe if we do this, maybe if we do that, when actually the data show that there's no likelihood of benefit. The number of people who benefit from intensive medical interventions when they're really in the late phase of a fatal disease is vanishingly small. The overwhelming likelihood is that you hurt the person. You go into the ICU when you think, I've got a decent chance that this might fix me up and send me on my way. If that's not going to happen, you know, you put somebody on a ventilator, they're very often restrained. It's uncomfortable to be on. It's, you know, it is, I'm sorry to put it this way because it's a life-saving thing. It's a rubber hose down your throat.
Mm-hmm.
It's no more fun than that sounds like. So if it saves your life, cool, that's great. You got to do it. You got to be sedated, but you won't be able to communicate easily with your family. You may need to be tied down. And if you're going to die, which indeed we all will, but if you are dying sooner rather than later, do you want to spend those last few months in the intensive care unit? Do you want to be in and out of the hospital? Do you want to be loaded up and sent to the emergency room where you sit on a gurney for 8 hours? For a lot of people, the benefit for that's just not there. So if we really rethought, how can we use our interventions wisely? If we have time, if we have, you know, things we can do, this person's not going to be with us after the next few months. What can we do to make those next few months the best they can be? What did this person value? Would she like to be around her friends? Would she like to be as awake as possible, given that you also make sure you control pain? Are there things that she can still enjoy and appreciate? Can we get some of that on board? You know, you can throw out issues around, I have to be really tightly controlled on diet and things like that. Forget it, man. this is the time to really go for it. You want a butterscotch sundae? You should totally have that. So I think we need to change some of the emphasis that medicine has.
Let's go to Nancy on line 9, who is calling us from Manhattan. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
I can. What's your question?
Okay. I wanted to know, and thank you for doing this segment because it is so important. Thank you, doctor, also. I wanted to know that when somebody has Alzheimer's, are they experiencing joy within their life that perhaps their loved ones, such as myself, cannot see and access? And I ask this because my mother, who was my soulmate, my bestest friend, was experiencing Alzheimer's towards the end, and she did pass, sadly. But later on, when I said to friends, oh, I miss her so much, I wish she was still with me, and friends, you know, meaning well, said to me, but at least you're not seeing her decline. And I said, how do I know that it was total decline? Maybe from my eyes on the outside, but maybe I couldn't access the joy that she could have been experiencing daily within her own world, within her own mind and universe. And therefore, I wish I would have been around and had her another 5 years or whatever it was. So I'm just wondering if you could maybe speak to that. If you know.
I can try to. It's such an interesting comment. And by the way, it sounds like you're a wonderful daughter, that you really were very devoted to your mother. So she was lucky to have you. It's very hard for us to understand the experience of people with really serious cognitive impairment because it undoes their capacity to communicate with us. I mean, that's just so hard. They can't tell us if they're in pain. They can't tell us if they're hungry necessarily. And they may not be able to tell us that we're happy. So we sometimes need to do guesswork. I think part of my issue is that people are so frightened of dementia that we just think of it as it's all loss all the time. And I don't think it needs to be that way. When you talk to people in the earlier phases of dementia, they can describe to you what feels good, what sounds good, and actually music is really wonderful for a lot of people. The part of your brain that contains music is one of the last standing. That thing is built to stay. So you definitely want to rely on that. But I would say for caring somebody with dementia, think about what that person loved. It may just be, can you give them a hand massage? That might just, your gentle touch might really be a way of giving joy to somebody. Is there the taste of food? They probably won't have a big thumping appetite, but are there foods that they really loved? Music, I think, is fabulous. Just being out, looking at a beautiful thing, being in a garden. I write about in the book that I love gardens, and I loved them when I was a little kid, and I'm betting I will love them if I become impaired. I'm still going to really just like the colors and like to see the little butterflies and birdies there. So trying to think about, who is this person? What does she care about? Can I give her some of that? What can I help her bring with her into dementia is something I'd really like to promote. So I think your question is really a great one.
Dr. Powell, I'm interested historically and culturally, where did all these stigmas come from dementia, about dementia? Why hasn't it just been seen as part of the aging process, potentially
right.
part of the aging process?
Such a good question. So I think dementia is really scary. People in America, if you do a big poll, this is the illness they're most frightened of, actually more than AIDS, more than cancer. Hmm. So stigma is often associated with fear, even, you know, racism, all kinds of things like that. People go, oh, I don't understand that. And there's this stigma and an anger and a rejection. So I think that's part of what's going on with dementia. I also think it isn't actually just part of the aging process, because there's normal cognitive aging. Mm-hmm. You know, we slow down in some ways, just the way we literally slow down. You probably don't, you know, I don't run as fast as I did when I was 20. I could
pop, you don't pop out of the bed the same way.
Yeah,
me
exactly.
neither.
Yeah. So some normal cognitive slowing, that's fine. We all do that. But that's different with dementia. The actual neurons die. They're not asleep. They're dead. They're gone. So there is a distinction. We didn't really appreciate that until starting maybe like 100 years ago, that actually some old people are not just slowing down as we all must, but there's a thing going on there. There's something different. So what is that stigma? You know, I mean, first of all, we're scared of death. Okay, fine. So that's true. We don't want to think about it. And we associate, I think not incorrectly, something that changes your mind feels like it robs you of yourself. Feels like you're not there. I don't think that's completely true, and it's certainly not true in the earlier phases of dementia, but I think that's quite frightening, that you, all of your memories, all the things you've loved in your life, the memory of your mother, of your kids, of your spouse, all of that stuff, to have somebody peel that away, that's scary. Mm-hmm. So I think the weight of that thought, that fear, makes us walk away from dementia. That sound of that fear is a door slamming, and it slams in, you know, it's in terms of health policy. It's not just like, oh, it's a little feeling. It's like what we spend money on. You know, we're actually shutting down nursing homes. We're, you know, a lot of things we're doing, I think, are a response to that fear and not a particularly logical one.
This is just something I'm observing, and I don't know if it is pertinent to the conversation or not. All of our calls are from women.
Interesting, yeah. So people say that dementia is a women's disease for a variety of reasons. Women live longer, so we're more likely to get dementia. Women, and there are wonderful men who do a lot of caregiving, but the majority of caregivers are definitely women. So women see this kind of coming and going. They're on the receiving end mm-hmm. of dementia in a variety of ways, and I think that's absolutely true. I interviewed an eminent professor at the Harvard School of Public Health a few months ago, and he doesn't think the incidence is different, the rate between men and women is different. It's more that women live longer, so we see it that way. But I do think that women are aware of this, they're frightened about it, and they are right in the midst of taking care of people they love.
We're going to try to squeeze in one last call in our last couple of minutes. Let's go to Mary Lou from NIAC. Hi, Mary Lou.
Hi. Hi, Tia. I was a student of yours when you taught with Baron, Nancy, and David the year before you went to Japan.
Wow.
And, and I'm here to give a practical suggestion. About 6 months ago, when I turned 70, the birthday present that I gave to myself is I had my driving assessed at the Helen Hayes Hospital, only because that's the nearest one, you know, for me.
And Mary Lou, we only have about a minute left, okay?
Okay. I think that the neurological and cognitive part of that testing could pick up nuances in people long before they're demonstrated to anybody else. So it's just a suggestion.
Mary Lou, thanks for calling in.
You're welcome.
In our last moments, is there anything else I didn't ask you that you think is really important in our last minute?
I think you asked great questions. I like the idea of testing. I don't think that driving tests predict dementia, but I'm into testing. I think we should test a lot of people as we get older. Doctors, judges, lots of people, I think, could use every decade testing.
Information is power, right?
Yeah.
The name of the book is Dementia Reimagined, Building a Life of Joy and Dignity from Beginning to End. My guest has been Dr. Tia Powell. Dr. Powell, thank you so much for joining us on All of It. We really appreciate it today.
Thank you. I had a great time visiting.
This is All of It on WNYC. Stay with us.